Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in African American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Nikazi Oates, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Timothy D. Walker about his new edited volume, Sailing to Freedom, Maritime Dimensions of the Underground Railroad. He is the professor of history at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. Timothy, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm so excited to have this conversation with you.
I am as well. Thanks.
So to begin, Tim, I want to just ask you to just tell a bit about yourself. Perhaps we can begin with you telling us about your research interest.
Well, I should start by saying that I'm a Midwesterner, and so I don't naturally come to maritime things, but it's kind of a result of what I decided to study when I undertook to become a teacher of history at the university level. So I moved to Boston for graduate school, and I started a program of early modern European history and Atlantic world. And it occurred to me that if I was going to really understand sort of organically and clearly what it meant to be one of the historical actors in a maritime overseas empire, I needed to know something about maritime history and about sailing. And so I, in very early in my graduate career during the summer, I signed aboard as a crew member for large sailing vessels out of Mystic, Connecticut and Mystic Seaport. And I started working on those vessels on and off over the next 15 or so years, eventually teaching on board some of them, teaching courses in maritime history on large traditionally rigged vessels. And so I gained a kind of insight into sailing and long distance, you know, moving of cargo and people by water in the early modern age of sail era. And that really helped to inform a lot of my academic work. So my main academic interests have to do with early modern Europe and its connections to the Americas through colonial links having to do with, you know, things like the transatlantic slave trade and movement of commodities and peoples and immigration and labor. My main focus of academic research has to do with the Portuguese and the Portuguese Overseas Empire. But it turned out that, you know, I got a job at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth, and because I had crewed on a large schooner that was based in New Bedford, I decided I wanted to live in this historic seaport town. And so I moved to New Bedford to be close to my job. And it's at that point that I really became fascinated in the local history. And it turns out that New Bedford was not only part of the Maritime Underground Railroad, but an important terminus for people who were escaping enslavement, fleeing to freedom. They often ended up in New Bedford because it was a particularly welcoming environment for them.
Wow. I am like struck by how, you know, when you began your graduate studies that you actually did not intend to, or enslavement wasn't a area of inquiry for you, but when you became a teacher, when you became an educator, a professor, it really led you down to this path, and you were teaching about sailing and whatnot. That's really fascinating.
Well, the study of slave trading by water is a necessary component when you deal with any overseas empire, particularly the Portuguese or the Dutch. But it was never a real close focus until a bit later in my academic career. But consequently, I've published a number of works, journal articles and so on, dealing with the Portuguese and their practices and the end of the abolition of slavery in the Portuguese world. But mostly I've focused on the Indian Ocean and the Asian region, the Portuguese Estado de India, the Asian part of their empire. So shifting to the Atlantic world had more to do with looking at enslavement in Angola and in Brazil. And in fact, so again, to digress a bit, one of my main focuses as a historian has to do with history of medicine. And so where that juxtaposes with the history of enslavement, you have people moving ideas and concepts and commodities of medicine through the slave trade, with people leaving, say, West Africa or East Africa with ideas about curing and healing, and then moving those ideas to places like Brazil or to India, Goa. And so there's one of the books that I edited has to do with medicine in Angola, written by a translation of a work written by an 18th century doctor who was working with the enslaved population in Angola.
Wow. Wow.
So you can see this is pretty far afield from from what I from the present work that I'm engaged in with the Underground Railroad in the United States.
Right. Wow. So Tim, I want to back up just a bit and talk about the particularly like the formations of us becoming scholars, right, and becoming researchers. So, you know, I think that in our profession, or just professions broadly, we don't talk enough about moments of insecurity or moments of doubt. So I've just wondered if you could tell us a moment of self-doubt that you had, either as a graduate student or as a faculty member, about a particular study that you were engaged in or something like that. But then on the flip side, recount a moment that you had great clarity as well as confirmation or reassurances in that you are looking at something that is really necessary for the field.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that, like many people who are just starting out in their graduate careers, that first semester of grad school is always a shock. Because you realize just the sheer amount of information that you're expected to consider and assimilate in the course of taking multiple classes and perhaps being a teaching assistant on top of that, or a grader or something. And so I think, you know, the first semester of my graduate career left me a bit uncertain that this was the path that I really wanted to take. But on the other hand, I'd always been so deeply engaged in history, and I, even from a very early age, my parents were very good about taking me to historic sites in the U.S. And I've always really felt this extraordinary need to help other people understand why things in the past matter and why they are so important for us to understanding our present. And so another time when I was really uncertain about myself is the first time that I really had to stare at, multiple pages of Portuguese manuscript documents from the 17th or 16th century and try to make sense of them. And, you know, not working in a language that is my first language, working in a language that I'm trying to understand and learn, and having real doubts about, am I getting these translations right as I'm making them myself? But where I felt vindicated then later was that, you know, I had Portuguese scholars and then later students tell me that they had had really gained something important and insights from the work that I had produced. And really where it all comes together for me and where I feel the most at home as in my profession and most comfortable in my profession, I think, is in the classroom, sometimes even teaching on board vessels where students who have very little maritime experience really begin to understand the importance of these kinds of themes and how important to understand the colonial world, to understand colonial empires, to understand the transatlantic slave trade, to understand how the American experience of gaining freedom through the War of Independence, the American Revolution, how maritime matters are so important to that. And people have told me that I'm fairly good at conveying that information. And that's where I feel where this has all been worthwhile and that I'm on the right path.
Yeah. And to that point, when you said, understand our colonial world and through maritime escapes, you know, this is a fantastic volume, Sail into Freedom. And you bring together about like 9 or 10 scholars through their essays that they contributed to this volume. Tell me a bit about how this came into being.
So the book itself grew out of a wonderful opportunity that I had here in New Bedford. There is an organization called the New Bedford Historical Society, led by a dynamo of a woman named Lee Blake, who focuses mainly on the experience of people of color in New Bedford, and this would include people of African descent who came both as free people and enslaved people to North America. It includes Native American populations that were here prior to Europeans and their descendants. But she came to me with the suggestion that we apply for a National Endowment of the Humanities grant called Landmarks in American History, the purpose of which is to bring teachers from all over the United States, K through 12 teachers, to a particular place and have them learn in depth over the course of a week or two the historical lessons of an important historical story that is important to that place. And so we did a program, a National Endowment for the Humanities program called Sailing to Freedom, New Bedford and the Underground Railroad. And in the course of this, we were successful in our application. We did it 3 times between 2011 and 2015. And we've been refunded to do it again now that the book is out. But in the course of doing that, we brought together a number of scholars and speakers who addressed the teachers with components of their own scholarship that kind of augmented the story and explained why people were escaping by sea and why they were coming to New Bedford. People like, Frederick Douglass, who comes to New Bedford and makes this place his first home in freedom, and hundreds of other people like him. In the course of doing that NEH project, we began to realize a number of things. One is that there was all this disparate scholarship that wasn't really speaking to one another about this particular theme, maritime escapes. And second, that the numbers of people who were escaping this way were far higher than most Underground Railroad scholarship acknowledges. And that really people hadn't historians of the Underground Railroad had not sufficiently examined this story, this component of escapes. And so we decided that this would be something that would be valuable and historiographically important. And so I took it upon myself to organize the volume, largely using scholars who had come as presenters to the NEH program that we ran, but also recruiting other people to cover other geographic areas that we hadn't covered in the course of our NEH program. So we got myself and 9 others who were able to cover most of the eastern seaboard of the U.S. I wanted to get people who were at differing stages of their careers. Some are independent scholars. Some are in tenure-track jobs in American universities. But all of them are experts in a particular place along the East Coast, either through which people who were escaping enslavement passed, or from which those escapes originated, or to which those escapes were directed to try to find safety in a northern city, typically a port city, where they could escape to. So that's pretty much how the book came together.
Wow. And just for some ground in for our listeners, could you define for us what are, or how you and the other scholars define maritime escapes?
So when we're talking about maritime escapes, you know, most of the attention of Underground Railroad historiography is focused on terrestrial overland escapes. And we wanted to focus on people who were escaping by water, but not just any water. We wanted this to be truly sort of ocean-borne, coastal. So anyone who's fleeing enslavement by long-distance waterborne means, using boats to get to larger vessels, maybe stealing a boat from shore, going down a riverway to a port, getting on board a vessel, getting aboard an ocean-going vessel on a dock or at a wharf in a southern port, and then fleeing using coastal waterways, often, you know, pretty deep water passages, hundreds of miles out to sea, where people would leave a southern port and then sail north to New York or Boston or New Bedford, some kind of ocean transit. Now we do look at some inland waterways. Some people escaped up the Mississippi River, but we really were looking at ocean passages as means of escape. And that's where most of the numbers are, people fleeing from ports in the south across the ocean to ports in the north.
Mm-hmm. Do you know how many enslaved people actually sailed to freedom?
Well, you know, we get this question a lot, and the question of numbers and quantifying the data. And it's important to recognize that the activity that we are examining is by its very nature clandestine. It's hidden because it was illegal. There were very serious consequences for being caught, either assisting or escaping enslavement by water. And so it didn't leave a lot of records behind. Now, what we can say is that, and where we do get a sense of some of the numbers, is through looking at some of the documentation. And one of the main documentations, types of documentation that we use is runaway slave ads. And so in the United States, newspapers from the pre-Civil War period, there are roughly 200,000 known publications of runaway slave ads. Not all of them have been digitized and analyzed, but of those 200,000, many of them are repeats. So you have the same ad that's been published multiple times. But the point is that an astonishingly high number of them, and I'm not going to hazard a guess at the percentage because they haven't all been studied yet, but a very high number of them involve masters who are advertising for the return of their property, and they put in the ad the suspicion that they have escaped by ship. And so slave owners who are putting in this data, and then you also have advertisements by captains of ships who claim in the advert, in order to give themselves legal coverage, that they did find a fugitive on board, they did land them in a place like New York or Boston, that they had no knowledge of it beforehand, and that they're not therefore responsible for this, but they're informing the owner of the property that their property is now, or at least was at last known point, in a place like Boston or New York or New Bedford. So to come back to your question, there's really no way to, with any kind of certainty, quantify exactly how many people fled by sea, but there is a way to say that that the numbers are very high. The final point I want to say about this is that almost all escapes from the very far south, from anywhere more than, you know, 100 miles or so south of a free state, all of the escapes from the deep south are made by water, because it was simply impractical to escape over land more than a few days' walk from a free state. And so that alone sets us up with the idea that a very large proportion of people who are escaping enslavement are doing so by water.
Mm-hmm. And to that point, you know, waterways were central during the 18th and 19th century, right? So could you also talk about that this method of escape is not, you know, not necessarily abnormal or what we might think is atypical as a way to abscond from chattel slavery?
Right. So, one of the things that we tend to forget in the first part of the 21st century is just how central maritime passages were to the economy, to the society, to communication within the early American Republic, and indeed during colonial times as well. There were no, or very, very few internal roads, even into the mid-19th century. Most travel along in the main eastern states, and the movement of heavy cargo and the movement of economic valued goods, you know, it's all done by water. And so right up until the time of the Civil War, you have at any given time thousands of small vessels at sea plying the eastern seaboard from north to south, moving goods produced in the south for processing in the north, goods produced in the north to help the economy of the south. And things are moving back and forth with such frequency that there are thousands upon thousands of coastal cargo and trade vessels always moving back and forth along the eastern seaboard. These would be small sloops or schooners or brigs that were essential to the internal economy of the United States, because you didn't have until the beginnings of the structure of the railroad system, which mainly existed in the north, you simply didn't have any means to do that. And so this provided an opportunity for persons of color who were enslaved to get aboard one of these vessels that was making a passage from a southern port to a northern port. And that knowledge was absolutely current and circulated within the enslaved community in the South. People understood very well that this was a way out. And not only did the enslaved population understand this, the owner class understood it too, because they passed laws and ordinances to keep this from happening. They knew that their ports were like a sieve with people escaping all the time. It was a huge loss to their economy, and yet to try to close those ports was unthinkable, because the commerce that they transacted was so important to the economy. I'd like to follow on just for a moment to add something that is also a key prerequisite to this whole story, and that's that the labor in the southern ports on the waterfronts, loading and unloading vessels, working in warehouses, bringing cargo down river systems from plantations to the ports for loading on vessels, ferry operators, fishermen, people gathering oysters and doing all kinds of waterfront work. It was all enslaved labor in the South, almost universally. And therefore, the people who are working along these waterfronts are gathering key strategic information that then they can use to allow themselves the opportunity to escape. So the kinds of information gathering, the understanding of currents and tides, knowing how to operate small vessels, knowing the schedules of ships sailing, knowing that they have to go out with the tide and the timing of that to get aboard a vessel as a stowaway. All of this is key strategic essential information that you only get through working in the maritime trades. Landlubbers who were just a few miles inland who you know, didn't have the opportunity of understanding the rhythm of the seas, did not have the essential knowledge to make those kinds of escapes.
Wow, that is such a critical point, that enslaved people who were working in ports, that they developed this embodied knowledge that could foster and actually help them as a strategy to figure out ways to escape via maritime when they feel they have found the right time to actually do so. That is actually a really great point, Timothy.
It's essential to understanding how this all worked because, you know, unlike the way we tend to perceive of the Underground Railroad, in which there are station masters and people who are conductors and networks of people helping fugitives who are fleeing by land, who are only moving maybe, you know, a few miles every night from one hidden location to another. And most of that network functioned in the north already to get fugitives away from people who would re-enslave them and drag them back to slavery. The way the maritime system worked is quite different. It usually relied on the would-be fugitives' own devices, their own knowledge, their own skills, their own capacities for making decisions that will allow them to escape to freedom. So many of these escapes are done as impulsive acts with very little help from persons on shore. To be sure, there were overseas or rather seaborne escapes that happened with planning and with help, but an enormous number of these escapes that we've been able to document are done by people acting on their own initiative and acting with only their own knowledge and resources. And that maritime knowledge was essential to making it happen successfully.
I'm wondering if we can account for gender to figure out who took advantage of this maritime escape. I know it's difficult to locate the precise numbers, but could you have scholars hypothesize when it comes to gender, who took advantage of this?
Well, it seems to be that the overwhelming majority of escapees by water were male. For reasons that we can fairly readily understand, most waterfront wharf and dockage work is done by men. Most of the watermen who are operating vessels are men. Now, we do know of a number of women who do escape, sometimes as part of families. They usually when there is some sort of agreement made with a vessel captain or crew to get more than one or two fugitives on board, the freedom seekers might contract with a captain to pay a fee to take them out of a southern port, or they might, and this is a case where you have clear pre-planning and there's an organized effort to do it. It isn't a spontaneous act. But in those cases, sometimes families would escape as a group, a few people. There were some known schooner captains who operated packet vessels that had a regular route that they ran from southern states to northern states. And there are a couple of them that William Still writes about in his book about the Underground Railroad. He operated out of Philadelphia as a well-known person who assisted with escapes. And he mentions a couple of different schooner captains who regularly would deliver people to him, and sometimes significant groups, a dozen or dozen people or so. And in those cases, women would escape. But your instances where it's one lone person acting often with very little planning and just opportunistically, that person is almost certainly going to be a male slave who makes their bid for freedom. Mm.
You know, a little while ago, you mentioned that, you know, enslaved owners knew that this was happening and they were trying to prevent enslaved people from using the maritime system. And that to undergo this particular escape is risky, right? And one of the authors of this volume actually pointed to that in one of the states, it was a potential capital crime, and which blew my mind. So I don't know if you could, you know, talk a little bit more about that, or just broadly help us think about the level of risk that maritime escape was, right? And was it dangerous than any other form of escape that enslaved people considered?
Yeah, it's an interesting question and a very important one. One thing to consider is that the law did not apply equally to persons of color who were enslaved, to persons of color who are free, and to free men who are white and women. So in several states, it was a capital crime to assist a fugitive to escape, particularly for and where the law fell the hardest was on free black people who were assisting slaves to escape. And that's partly because they're the most vulnerable in any slaveholding society. A free black person has very few protections under the law. So there were free black sailors, for example, that were hung for assisting fugitive slaves to escape in the South. We're speaking specifically here about North Carolina, and the author who I'm referring to, who is a contributor to the book, is David Soselsky, who writes about North Carolina in his chapter of the book, which is the third chapter. But beyond that, one of the things that enslaved people risked, you know, as a commodity, these people were extraordinarily valuable, and they understood something about their value. What that means is that they often themselves, if they were property, they wouldn't necessarily be executed for trying to escape. Instead, what they risked was being sold to a part of the southern U.S. where working as a slave was in itself a death sentence. So to be sold to areas where the labor was so brutal and so harsh that few people survived it for more than a few seasons. And that was a punishment and a threat that that people who owned enslaved humans would hold over their head to say, look, if you insist in this these attempts to get away, I'm going to make your life far worse than it is now. So you know, one of the things that I came to realize in the course of putting the material together for this book is that a lot of enslaved persons, particularly if they worked in maritime trades, had an enormous amount of autonomy in their labor, because if they were part of a crew that went out on a fishing vessel and the crew was entirely composed of enslaved people, their day-to-day work was done often without the vigilance of a slave master or owner. If they were a ferryman or, you know, worked in many of the maritime trades, they weren't constantly being overseen by someone who was answerable to their owner. Instead, they had lives that allowed them a fair amount of freedom, if you will, and also the opportunity to earn money doing side jobs that might then lead, at least in the early part of the 19th century, that might allow them to purchase their freedom. So the threat of being sold to the plantations of the far South was, of the deep South, was a very real threat. And this is something that was at risk if one made an escape attempt and then was caught and brought back to enslavement.
Mm-hmm. I know you mentioned this before, but I just want to highlight this. What were some of the typical states that enslaved people went to when they, went through the waterfront? What were
some of the destinations?
The states?
Yeah.
What were some of the destinations?
Sure.
To just once again to think about geographic locations and all of that.
Right. So many of the northern ports in free states had longstanding relationships, commercial relationships with Southern ports, and they were exchanging, you know, things like timber and cotton and molasses and things that were being sent north for processing or for being turned into ships. And so there's constantly traffic going back and forth. Some of the main places that enslaved people would try to get to would be New York City, which was an important transit point. Wasn't the safest place for a person who was a freedom seeker trying to get away from enslavement, because there were bounty hunters always on the lookout for people who looked like they might be fugitives. But if you could get to Connecticut or Massachusetts parts of Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, New Jersey, these were places that you could then transit through to try to get to a safer place, going inland to upstate New York, crossing the border into Canada. But New Bedford and Boston were places where large communities of former enslaved people, self-emancipated people, gathered because they were relatively safe because of the important abolitionist communities that operated in those cities, both people of color and white abolitionists in Boston and in New Bedford, who would do a lot of work, not only to welcome and find jobs for fugitives, but also to protect them if slave catchers came to their communities. The abolitionist community in New Bedford, for example, prided itself that no one had ever been taken back to slavery once they had achieved freedom in New Bedford. I should also point out that one of the reasons why New Bedford became a destination is that the whaling industry provided a number of opportunities for fugitive slaves. One, it was largely in the hands of Quakers, who by the mid-19th century were strongly anti-slavery. And the whaling industry provided labor if you were a male who had some sea experience, or even if you didn't, you could sign on to a whaling voyage that typically lasted 2 to 3 years, and you could earn some money, and by the time you got back, the heat would be off in terms of someone trying to find you and bring you back into enslavement. And so the community of New Bedford had this reputation for being a particularly viable place to settle, so much so that it became known as the Fugitives' Gibraltar for keeping the fugitive population safe. Mm.
You know, in the past couple of years, I would say 5 to 10 years, there have been a lot of media attention or media narratives around or about the Underground Railroad, right? One that, you know, debuted last weekend, right? And then a name that has gotten a lot of attention, rightfully so, right, is Harriet Tubman, and, you know, known as the conductor or one of the conductors of the Underground Railroad. I wonder, and as I was reading this volume, I wondered if there was sort of a similar type of position, or, you know, these positions are scholars are naming these positions, right? But I wonder if to think about this particular form of escape, maritime escape, are there any formerly enslaved people that actually assisted slaves that we should know about, and try to think about, really think about this as a robust, important method of escaping?
Yeah, I've thought a bit about this, and the short answer is, you know, almost certainly there were former slaves who had successfully escaped, who then used their experience to try to help others to escape. Almost certainly, but rarely documented. And one of the reasons that it isn't documented is, of course, because it was a crime, and people didn't want to be punished for what they were doing, so they didn't say much about it. And often until years and years later, a lot of the narratives that are published that we used in the book for some of our key information about how all of this worked. Those narratives are not published until, in some cases, until after the Civil War. But some circumstances under which self-emancipated people might have helped others to escape might have been in terms of getting messages and correspondence about how to achieve freedom through maritime means. They could have sent messages through third parties to some of their family or loved ones still in bondage in the South. And of course, because literacy was a problem, they often had to do this verbally or through intermediaries that could have been free black sailors, for example, which is why they were often in trouble in the South. Free black sailors in particular, especially if they're serving on Northern ships, increasingly during the 19th century, Southern white people of the owner class tried to control free black sailors by insisting that they stay aboard their vessels whenever in port in the South, or sometimes even incarcerating them with a bond so that they wouldn't interact with the enslaved black population in the South, because they were certain that free black sailors were encouraging enslaved black wharf workers and waterfront workers to escape. And they were probably right in those suspicions. So another thing that happened is that some of the people who achieve freedom by sea end up serving in Northern regiments, like the 54th Massachusetts, which recruited in New Bedford and in Boston and other places. And we have a number of instances where we know that soldiers who fought against slavery in the Civil War were, in fact, fugitives who had achieved freedom by sea. One of those is William Kearney, who lived in New Bedford, had escaped from, I believe it's North Carolina, I might be wrong about that, and he ends up being the first African-American soldier to earn the Medal of Honor ever in the United States for his acts of valor at Fort Wagner in 1863. So the legacy is enormous, and we want these stories to become better known as much as we want to change the way people think about how the Underground Railroad functioned and to think about it as this land and sea-based effort that was going on simultaneously.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And to that point, that you want to reconceptualize the Underground Railroad as both land and sea escape routes, I'm struck by the way that you have thought about maritime escapes all the way back to when you received the NEH grant to do this, right? And you titled the seminar as Sailing to Freedom, Maritime Escapes and the Underground Railroad.
Well, New Bedford and the Underground Railroad, yes.
I'm sorry, New Bedford and the Underground Railroad. And I think there's work there with the conjunction and I think about the volume, right? And the subtitle here, Maritime Dimensions of the Underground Railroad, right? So I, in thinking about conceptualizing the field and what the contributors have done, I'm thinking about how should we as researchers, as scholars, as educators, and just listeners think about maritime escapes, right? Should we think about it as a subfield within Underground Railroad studies, or should we think of it as its own separate field, distinct but important to the Underground Railroad studies? I know you wrote in your contribution the historiography of Underground Railroad studies, but in terms of conceptualizing it, what do you have to, how are you thinking about it?
I think from my perspective as a scholar and as one who has, you know, recently completed editing this volume, I see the maritime side of the Underground Railroad as being squarely within the field of Underground Railroad studies. That is to say, the maritime dimension is a distinct part of the main story. And I don't see it as separate from the Underground Railroad story, because I think the objectives were the same. Had people in the inland part of the United States had this opportunity, they certainly would have taken advantage of it to escape, but they didn't. And so consequently, I think this has to be seen as an effort that is alongside the terrestrial overland escape methods, but being, you know, equally important, because the numbers that we've uncovered are really significant and really very, very large numbers of people. And the idea that it simply was not practical to escape overland from anywhere further than just a few days away from a free state, it was the chances of being caught, of being picked up as a fugitive, of being intercepted by a slave patrol, made overland escape very, very difficult for long distances. And so most of the terrestrial escapes happen quite close to free states. Whereas if we think about the maritime side of the Underground Railroad, you could avoid a lot of that, a lot of the chance of being captured en route to escape, if you were aboard a vessel 100 or so miles offshore, where there are no slave patrols, where your ship is generally speaking not going to be stopped. The only place where you might be checked is going in and out of a port. But typically, slaves were very savvy about this. They had the maritime knowledge to know when a vessel's next port of call was going to be a free state. They often would try to get aboard those vessels because they knew that their chances of escape were much, much higher. So to get back to your question, I feel like that this is sort of the understudied half of the Underground Railroad story that really needs to be fully appreciated if you're going to have a comprehensive understanding of what the Underground Railroad was and how it functioned. That's not to say that people who did manage to escape to a free northern port by ship didn't engage with Underground Railroad networks. They did. So when they got to Philadelphia or New York or some of the other cities where they were really at risk of being re-enslaved, they relied on Underground Railroad conductors to get them to places where they were less likely to be recaptured. But that initial jump from slavery to freedom, if done by water, was a much more certain path to freedom than over land.
Mm-hmm. And in the effort to highlight this understudied dimension of the Underground Railroad, you served as the editor and the visionary and the person who would shepherd this this volume. So tell me a little bit about what was your experience like being editor of this volume, and how did you structure this volume?
Well, you know, a lot of people warn me about becoming an editor of a collected volume, and in fact, the press wondered when I initially pitched this topic, and the press was very excited about it. They really liked the idea and the topic, and they were very supportive right from the beginning. But they said, you know, why not make this a monograph and write it yourself rather than have the challenge of coordinating a lot of different authors? And I said, well, first of all, I don't have the expertise to cover all of these geographic areas myself, and second, there are a lot of other voices that I've come to know through my experience as being the director of this NEH program that I'd like to give all these folks an opportunity to really showcase the scholarship that they've been working on for a long time. So I organized the volume geographically from north to south, from south to north, I beg your pardon, from South Carolina, beginning in South Carolina, and then following right up the eastern seaboard coast with chapters that focus on North Carolina and Virginia and Maryland, and then one on New York City, one on Connecticut, and one on two that focus on Massachusetts, one specifically on New Bedford and one more generally on Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket, the Cape and Islands, and New Bedford. And And then the final chapter, which I was really happy to include, talks about new research opportunities through digital media and digital libraries, online archives that are working on gathering and digitizing and making searchable all of these tens of thousands of runaway slave advertisements that exist in early American newspapers. So we finish up the book with kind of a call for new and further research. And of course, what everyone hopes who engages in a project like this, you hope that you're going to have spin-off projects that will take your ideas and your scholarship even further and into greater detail. So, you know, we're already aware that there are places that the book wasn't able to cover as well. And we hope that other scholars will step up and make a richer picture from the one that we've provided as a kind of starting point.
Yeah, it really is a great starting point, and it's fantastic, and it's really cutting edge. And I want everyone to read it who listens to this interview, because this is really rich, really rich. And as you rightfully acknowledge, throughout the book and in this interview, is that this is really understudy. But if you look back at some of the enslaved people that we have come to know, they escape using waterways, right? I think Harriet Jacob is one that came to mind in reading this as well. So this is fantastic work, and I thank you so much for doing this. And actually, pushing back to the editor and say, like, no, like, this is a collaborative effort, and I'm not the only one who is interested in this work as well as doing this work. So it's really great.
Well, I'm glad that you found it so rewarding to read, and that it has sparked your imagination about ways to maybe take this story and disseminate it and make it a real integral part of the Underground Railroad story.
Yeah, absolutely. So before we go, do you mind telling us what you're working on next?
Sure, I'd be happy to. In fact, I'm really excited about a project that is related in many ways to the material that is in the present volume that we're discussing. So as you know, I live in New Bedford, Massachusetts, and I've sailed out of here, and I've been very interested in the intersection of the Underground Railroad and the whaling industry. But there's another really important component of this. New Bedford holds easily half, if not more than half, of the known whaling logbook records for Yankee whalers, American whalers, going back to the 18th century. And in those logbooks, you have very detailed data from every day of a voyage on a whaling voyage that could last, 2, 3 years, 4 years, going to some of the most remote places on the planet. You have weather data from every daily log entry. And so I've teamed up with a ocean climatologist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, and we are systematically going through logbooks and recording weather data, which then my partners at Woods Hole are analyzing and using that to model climate change information, and making models about how weather changes from the 18th century to the 20th. And because I also have a lot of experience in Portuguese and Dutch colonial archives, we're using those logbooks from Dutch and like East India Company records, Dutch VOC records, Portuguese records going to Asia. We're pushing back the climate picture another 200 years to the 16th century to gather weather data from those logbooks. So, it's once you get into the maritime realm of documentation and the available data in archives, you can do all kinds of fascinating stuff with it. And so I'm very excited to work on this climate problem with historical documentation that is unique to the maritime fields.
Wow. Once again, another innovative project, an important project. This sounds fascinating, Timothy. It really does.
Well, I'll send you a couple of links. We've actually got some nice media coverage of what we've been doing in the last couple of years, and I'm happy to share that with you.
Oh, please, please do.
My partner at Woods Hole is called Caroline Umenhofer, and she's a great ocean scientist, and we've just been doing a lot of work that we're really proud of and really excited about.
Wow. Well, Timothy, I want to thank you so much for being in conversation with me.
I'm so happy that you found your way to my recent book, and thank you so much for having me on your show.
Thank you. So this is Timothy. Timothy is the editor of Sailing to Freedom, Maritime Dimensions of the Underground Railroad. And our listeners who wish to order the book may use the promo code MAS022, which is good for 30% off the cover price of the book and free shipping when purchased through the University of Massachusetts Press website. Timothy, thanks again. I really enjoyed it. And have a good afternoon.
You too, Nkosi. It was a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.